You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. This week is our monthly conversation with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn. Since the last time we talked, the MSU Board of Regents voted down a library project that would have used student fees to finance a new library. The board cited planned cuts in state appropriations and an increase in student tuition as a few of a number of reasons to nix the plan. Dr. Dunn joins me to talk about that and how the state budget outlook could halt any major plan construction for some time. Let's begin with the state budget, Dr. Dunn. Does it still look like MSU will lose close to 6.4% in state funding during the state's two-year budget?
Yes, Chad, as we tape, we really do expect at this point that what has been a constant throughout, and that is the loss of about $3.2 million for Murray State University, as a cut going into next year will in fact be maintained. And we understand the challenges to the Commonwealth. There are these flickers that the economy's coming back. Some signs of leading indicators are pretty good, but certainly we're going to have another couple of tough years as we get through the next biennial budget. Here at the university, as you and I have mentioned before, we're not looking for the next year to make any kind of drastic or large or whipsaw changes to programs and services here at the university. We have, over the years, put aside sufficient operating reserves to deal with this loss of the $3.2 million that we anticipate, and that with a very modest budget increase via tuition. We're not going to see tuition jump drastically. It's going to be very moderate, I think. But with that, to kind of backstop things, we'll get through next year okay. What we will be doing, though, in that cushion year, if I can call 12-13 that, is to put together a number of budget planning and review committees. Again, this will be with the approval of the board as they next meet in regular session on June 1st. But we'll then take 2012-13 with a number of these budget planning and review teams to really look at our financial model, some of the things that we're doing that maybe we could shed off, looking at alternative revenue sources, possibly limiting or cutting some programs and services to figure out how we adapt to this loss of a significant amount of state support for the long haul. We can't keep going back and just, you know, pounding tuition increases every year. And we don't see the state being able to come back in a big way to change their level of funding. So we are going to have to make some tough decisions. Luckily, we have the benefit of a year working off of some reserves again to go through in a systematic, organized, comprehensive process to make those choices, to make those recommendations that the board then would look at about a year from now. So it's going to be a difficult time, but it's not that we're in crisis mode. We can work through this, I think, in a fashion that allows us to make some wise, thoughtful decisions without just doing things at the drop of a hat.
Also, the Murray State Board of Regents at their last meeting, and this may coincide with the budget situation for the state, but decided to vote down the option of building a new university library with student fees, which came as a surprise to many because that was the number one agency project that the board had identified. Does this close the door on a student fee funding system for anything at Murray State?
Well, I don't know that that's the case, and in part I say that because board members will change over time. I think this particular board is very clear that they did not want to go forward with student fees as a basis for funding new library construction. And again, I don't want to speak for them per se, but philosophically, it is my sense that they saw this as a project that should be state funded. Now, you are right. They listed this initially as an agency bond project last August when they met on the basis of student fees. But as they looked at it more, did some more thinking about it, balanced it against other construction demands of the campus over the coming years, ultimately decided that they did not want to move forward with fees as the basis for funding a bond to get a new library built. Now, that doesn't mean that a future board couldn't come back and revisit that. It doesn't mean that there might not be a similar project in the future that they might want to entertain fees on. But for the instant purpose expressed, a brand new library bonded with student fee revenue They felt that they had looked at it sufficiently and talked it through to say, you know, we're at the point where we don't see going forward with that, and made that clear in their vote that day.
Now, the possibility of a new building, any building on campus being built with state-appropriated funds is not likely this biennium for the next 2 years and maybe beyond that?
That's right. We, again, as we tape today, we don't know what ultimately will come out of the final budget. But I'm pretty well willing to bet the family farm that we're not going to see any sort of new construction that's being funded by the state on the bonds that it would carry. Given that, we're probably looking at least 2014 for any kind of movement whatsoever on what the board's number one priority for state-funded projects would be, as opposed to agency bonds. Agency bonds we pay for ourselves. But the number one project for the board for state-funded construction through a bond is the engineering physics building to finish out the new West Science campus. There is not going to be any money for that in the 12-14 biennial budget for the Commonwealth of Kentucky. I'm just, you know, positive of that as we sit here today. Now, interestingly, one of the things that may well make it through this last budget review process and get signed into law is the reallocation of $4 million. And this was from a separate project in a different part of the state that we had nothing to do with. But $4 million from somebody else's ag project. I think it was Kentucky Agricultural Heritage Museum or something of that nature that didn't get completed. And we had given to us in the governor's budget proposal $4 million from that project to get started with work on a new Breathitt Veterinary Center out in Hopkinsville. And we do anticipate, given what we know today, that that will be sustained through the state's budget. So given that, we're now kind of looking at two fronts. We want to keep telling the story about the need for the engineering physics building to finish the West Science campus, but it well could be that we're going to see some sort of support given to get moving on Breathitt. Now, we didn't push or lobby or advocate for that $4 million. It came to us in the governor's budget proposal, actually somewhat as a surprise. But the concern here is that if the BVC moves forward, that has to be seen as kind of a separate project that the agricultural community, you know, such as Kentucky Farm Bureau and other groups, advocates, so that we don't have any loss of focus or taking our eye off the ball on the engineering physics building. This stuff gets very complicated, looking at source of funds. Is it state or is it agency bond that we pay for ourselves? Who introduces the project? How long does it take for funding to come? On a large project, it hasn't been unusual here in Kentucky to see funding come in two phases. So all of this kind of comes together to say, I don't know when we may see movement on a library. If it turns out that the Breathitt Veterinary Center becomes the Murray State project. Now, again, we don't want that to happen. If it takes place, great, but we can't not keep moving on the engineering physics building. But let's say in kind of the worst case scenario, the only project we get is Breathitt Veterinary Center. That takes potentially two biennia to fund in phases. Well, that becomes 2014, 2016. Then we would hope we get the engineering physics building right behind that if they don't give us both projects. Well, what happens if that happened to turn into a two-phase project, 2018, 2020? Then you're looking at maybe at least 2022 before we even start talking about a state-funded library at that point. Now, all of that is to say that we're going to have to spend the next year or so thinking about other alternatives. Maybe it becomes a renovation project. You know, maybe we just totally rethink what we do with the library as a book depository and things of that nature. We don't know yet, but we don't have to decide that right away. What we know is that this board has made clear through their action that student fees will not be a basis for new library funding. There's no plan B at this point. We'll start looking at that probably through 2013 in anticipation of the next biennial budget and look at what type of authority we'd request at that time.
And there is another project, though, that is moving forward associated with Murray State and the city of Paducah, McCracken County, and that is the extended campus in Paducah. Where are we with that project, knowing it's moving forward?
Well, of course, we had a very successful bond sale, got a great rate on those bonds. The design process had been moving forward from that. We're working with an architectural firm that had gone through a project selection process with us. And at this point, we have some renderings of the facility. We're sharing those with various parties involved. Given an acceptance of those, we'll start working on final specifications, drawings. And at this point, we're looking at doing a groundbreaking there tentatively on April 27th. If we can get all of our ducks in a row with final renderings and that type of thing, we'd like to break ground and then get in there and start earth moving not too long after that once the exact design is finished.
And do we have a deadline for opening?
Well, you know, we'd initially hope that we might be able to do that for the fall of 13. That's going to be tough. It's not the fact that we've declared it impossible, but we know it's going to be a pretty tight timeline. So optimally, we'd have it ready to go with the start of the 13-14 academic year. May not make it, and if that's the case, we understand, and we'll go ahead and have what you would call a soft opening, maybe mid-semester, and start it with classes and services at kind of the logical semester point during that year.
We'll return with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn in a moment.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. We're back with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn, and we meet monthly. You can hear this entire conversation lodged on our website at WKMS.org. Murray State Racers had a great run through their regular season, the OVC tournament, and the NCAA tournament, and fell short against Marquette. But I'd like to hear your take on the season and your experience at the NCAA tournament.
How about in answer to those questions, it was awesome.
I bet it was.
Well, it really was exciting to see. And, you know, a lot of things come to mind when you phrase a question like that. But we did have the opportunity to travel with the team and hundreds of our fans, both to Nashville for the OVC and Louisville for the NCAA rounds. You just have to feel so good for our student athletes, for coaching staff, Coach Prohm. They've put their heart and soul into this. They have such wonderful chemistry. They get along well. And it's nice to see, you know, good things happen to good people. And I think in large part that is what took place here. Not to take away from their talents and coaching ability and all of that, but there was something beyond that that gelled that team. It's an honor and a blessing to be part of something like that. It doesn't happen on a lot of campuses, and to get to experience it is really neat. I will say this, it's good to have Rhonda back a little more normal now that the season is over. She would really get worked up, as many of our fans do. I mean, You can see them at the CFSB Center and elsewhere. She would get so nervous before games. She couldn't eat, she wouldn't talk, kind of went into this zone. And I know we have others who follow their own kind of superstitions and routines about that, who follow the team. So the run was fun. Now we're back to a little normalcy and get ready for next year.
And Coach Steve Prohm's contract has been renegotiated.
That's right.
And does that all rise to your level as well? I know many contract negotiations stay in the department level. How do you play into that?
No, of course. Yeah. You know, when you're looking at a contract that's multi-year and of that amount, absolutely, it comes by the president's desk. But Alan Ward was the point person in negotiating for the university, obviously working with our general counsel's office, working with HR staff. And I do think we hit about the right balance. We wanted to show our commitment to Coach Prohm and, you know, really indicate to him that we valued what he's done here and desired his continuing service. But at the same time, we wanted to stay within the general profile of an OVC middle mid-major school, if I can use that term, in terms of the overall compensation. Now, when the right big school comes for Coach Prohm, we're not going to be able to do anything about that. And that's kind of Murray State University's history. It's a mid-major situation for most public mid-majors, quite frankly. Now, we're not talking about Butler, we're not talking about Gonzaga, but for most places similarly situated to Murray State, that's kind of how the world works. But we did want to do everything we could within our profile or our sector to make the strongest commitment to Steve as possible. And ultimately, we were successful in doing so, and we'll get him for another year or two and greatly benefit from that, knowing that he has a career trajectory that's just going to be wonderful for him.
And also, there's work going on at the CFSB Center as we speak to build the new practice facility, helped in large part by the donation by CFSB for the naming of that facility. Where are we with that project, and when do you expect that to?
Well, for our listeners who are close to Murray and ever have a chance to drive by the north side of the CFSB Center, they will see a lot of activity going on. Right now, it's a lot of earthwork that's getting done, a lot of ground being moved, some of that preliminary infrastructure getting laid. But you're going to see continued work there here through the summer to have that ready to go. You're right. CFSB had given us a wonderful gift in purchasing the naming rights for the arena. We've also had a number of other donors who've stepped up very significantly to help make this possible as well. And, we appreciate that. One of the things that, you know, everyone has to remember, if there's a true kind of a spirit or desire on the part of a campus and a community, as I think there is for basketball at Murray State, to be at a certain level, there are certain things that you have to do to accomplish that. And we were really at kind of a pivot point over the past couple of years. And this is something that Alan Ward and I had talked about a number of times. If we really wanted, and I try not to use cliches, but this one fits. If we really wanted to try to push up to the next level of competition for the sector we're in, there were certain things we were going to have to do. We were going to have to figure out how to get a practice facility. This is a multi-purpose regional arena, and we have a pledge to the region to make it available for a variety of purposes. We couldn't be shuttling the basketball teams, both men's and women's, off to other sites to get practices done. We've had to figure out a way to do that, and that has, you know, led to the practice facility addition. We knew that at some point we were going to have to be looking at kind of pushing the salary ceiling. This has us at the top of the Ohio Valley Conference schools. We understand that. Highest coach's salary ever paid at Murray State University. But to do certain things that our community expects, it takes responses that the university makes, the Department of Athletics makes, and we're trying to do that while maintaining a balance around these, you know, these other considerations of the type of school we are and what the norms for, you know, a public regional university are as we live with them.
Let's change subjects here about a recent article in the Murray State News where the Student Government Association has removed their ties from the annual presidential lecture series.
Right.
It was related to the commitment that they had previously made to pay for a portion of the expenses for bringing Mary Madeline and James Carville here for this year's lecture. And they've since have a dispute over the cost of that lecture. And I'd like to hear your take on what's going on with this situation.
Well, there are really kind of two things happening here, one of which is the immediate case that you talk about, and the other is what they plan to do for the future. I think it's fair to say that we believe that it was clear on the front end what was going to happen with their level of support for the lecture. You have to remember, Chad, that when the lecture was instituted, really as a kind of a signature event on campus a number of years ago before I arrived, there was a funding source put together, and the bulk of that was SGA. And again, I wasn't here for those discussions or the level of involvement of students in making that decision, but certainly inherited that funding model when I came and we continued it. With regard to James Carville, Mary Madeline this year, we thought it was clear as to what the obligation was in terms of the total package of funding for that. And we continue to talk with SGA to get that resolved, but I don't think that there was any sleight of hand, certainly. However, for the future, they've indicated that they want to take on their own set of activities. They've gotten very involved in lectures that they're sponsoring. In fact, SGA brought Maya Angelou to campus early this year. They've done a number of other lectures. And so I understand that. They may want to put more money into concerts, which I think is a great thing, and have indicated that they think it's time that they get out from under the presidential lecture for the future. I have no argument with that. In fact, as I had indicated to our SGA president that I agree, this thing is billed as the presidential lecture. We're the ones kind of doing the negotiations to get individuals to campus for it. And it seems only appropriate as the SGA has set forth some other things they want to do. And, you know, it's not the SGA lecture. I fully agree with them and understand for the future that, you know, they'd like to put their money in some different things. And we're at the point, you know, after this many years, if it's called the presidential lecture, it really becomes my responsibility working with Murray State University Foundation to determine the funding and not call it one thing and have the students paying for it. I get that.
The last topic here, briefly, there was a tragedy on campus just a few weeks back, the day of the Murray State game.
Yes.
Against Colorado State. And I wanted to know how the university responds to a tragedy like this that occurred with a student jumping off the Fine Arts building.
Well, it would take another program to kind of walk you through all the protocols and practices of various groups. I will say this, that I think looking from afar, because we were trying to deal with it from Louisville, or a number of us on senior staff, but we had people on the ground here, Vice President Don Robertson, our Director of Counseling, Bill Albritton, one of our Associate Provosts, Renee Duncan, who has a psychology background, stepped in, as well as public safety, emergency management, people in the building where this studio was located, fine arts faculty. Everyone came together and played their roles that I think provided a wonderful response on the part of the campus. Everyone just stepped in and knew what they needed to do, you know, based upon our general emergency guidelines. Don working with the families, counseling staff setting up how we were going to handle that. Our first responders kind of knowing their roles, coordinated by Chief David DeVos with MSU Public Safety. What our biggest challenge was for that was to make sure that communication was clear and flowing. And that's always a challenge in these crises. I mean, a number of listeners I know have followed the Virginia Tech news and the lawsuits that have come out of that even this many years later. So we're always looking at ways to make sure we get accurate information communicated as quickly as possible. And there's always a balance. You don't want to send out something that's wrong. But when you have a student suicide on campus, particularly of this nature, you can't be sitting there half a day waiting to get news out either. And it's always a challenge. So we're going to keep looking at that. In fact, we have a post review that's taking place this week on that incident. We're going to look at ways to keep refining our processes. But I will say, again, just as a general statement, I think the response here worked out very well, showing comfort and sensitivity to the family, trying to respond to the needs of our students and staff members who actually witnessed this event, you know, was a very strong attempt that's still ongoing, by the way, with our counseling sessions to serve, you know, the various audiences here. You always wonder what was missed, if something could have been done. When you have 10,000 plus students, you hate to say it, but this does happen sometimes. And it's not even the first one on this campus since I've been president here 5.5 years. But you want to try to catch everything that you can through our early warning systems, which are strong. And then the type of response that we saw, I do think, was appropriate. And we'll keep working to refine that as we go.
Well, Dr. Dunn, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Nearly 90% of the corn in this country is genetically modified. And as using genetically modified, or GM corn, becomes increasingly popular in everyday foods, more people are becoming concerned about potential ill effects on human health and the environment. As Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, besides being used in food, that corn is also finding its way into Kentucky's signature spirit, bourbon.
I'm just going to heat this up.
In the grain room at the Four Roses Distillery, master distiller Jim Rutledge is microwaving corn kernels. He takes the glass out, shakes it, and buries his nose in the scent.
Got a very sweet, very clean aromas. If there's anything off, anything different than this, no matter how slight, and if it's anything off at all, we will reject the load.
Tainted corn means tainted bourbon, so it's important to make sure each batch is good. Rutledge's corn looks like any other corn, but it's different from the corn that goes into nearly every other Kentucky bourbon. It's not genetically modified. Last year, 88% of all corn grown in the United States was genetically modified, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This means it's getting harder for companies to find non-GM corn. Rutledge says Four Roses is only able to keep getting it because the company is willing to pay a premium for its corn. And the farm group they've been using for 52 years is still GMO-free.
You know, they're giving it to us right now how long it can last, because if you start out in the Midwest, just about all the crops that are grown use GMO materials. And as it spreads wider and wider and wider across the U.S., it will eventually become virtually impossible to have really GMO-free corn.
The shortage has already forced larger companies like Brown-Forman to change strategies. Spokesman Phil Lynch says the company decided to use only non-GM corn for its Jack Daniel's whiskey in 2000, based on consumer perceptions. But a decade later, that wasn't an option.
Ultimately, it just became impossible to source enough non-GM corn in order to make enough whiskey.
There are a few reasons for that. More and more farmers are choosing to plant GM seeds because they yield hardier crops that require fewer pesticides. And those genetically modified crops often contaminate other fields through cross-pollination, which means that some farmers are finding keeping their crops GMO-free is beyond their control. So, should you care if you're drinking genetically modified corn in your bourbon? The jury's still out. Chances are, you're already consuming a lot of GMOs in products like soda and canola oil. Doug Gurian-Sherman is a scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says there's no conclusive evidence that the GMO products on the market today are dangerous to human health, but
there could be many different types of genetically engineered genes from many different sources put into our crops in coming years. And with an inadequate regulatory system, we don't feel that we can be as confident as we should that those crops are going to be safe.
The United States doesn't have a labeling requirement, though most other developed nations do. And Gurian-Sherman says the government is placing too much of the onus on companies to ensure their product is safe for human health. The bourbon companies say using GM corn in their products isn't a concern because there's no genetically modified material left in the bourbon after distillation. Several manufacturers cited scientific studies they say confirm this, but the Kentucky Distillers Association wasn't able to produce the research and wouldn't return further calls for comment. And even companies like Four Roses that could market their products as GMO-free don't. Four Roses' Jim Rutledge.
Well, no, we don't market. We don't advertise.
Rutledge figures someday he won't be able to find GM-free corn to use in his bourbon. But when that day comes, Four Roses will still have at least 6 years of non-genetically modified bourbon aging in barrels. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
According to the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Kentucky possessed a 31% obesity rate in 2010, one of the highest in the nation. Naturally, kids are following suit. However, when families strategize ways in which to fight the obesity epidemic, is more activity a key or a curse? Casey Northcott reports.
On a Saturday morning in the Paducah Recreation Center, four children wiggle through a dance routine. Certified Zumbatomics instructor Eve Cotter takes the popular dance exercise Zumba and simplifies it for ages 4 through 12. Cotter says the class gets kids burning calories while enjoying pure, simple motion.
It's fun. It's not like the formatted aerobics classes. That's why if you look at anything Zumba, it says join the party, because it's just fun. You get up and dance, and they build confidence and, you know, yell at the top of their lungs, and it's beautiful.
Programs like Zumbatomics, as well as intramural sports, coax children away from the glow of their gaming systems. In today's society, this activity is vital. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, Kentucky had a 37% child obesity rate in 2007. That's a 17.5% increase from 2003. Children need more sunshine, grass, dirt, and sweat. They need more activity. But while organized sports programs, dance rehearsals, and martial arts classes can boost the health of children, their parents can suffer as a consequence. Registered dietitian Sherry Ford.
While the kids are doing a good thing, playing sports or involved in something that's, you know, maybe academic team or drama or basketball, they may not be good for the overall family because the family's focus now becomes the kids and they just eat on the run trying to fit the kids' schedule into their hectic lifestyle.
And grabbing a Big Mac and fries from McDonald's 2 to 3 times per week can take a toll. Ford says when people eat in restaurants, they consume an average of 30% more calories than when they eat at home. The United States Department of Agriculture supports this statement. The department published a study in 2002 saying food prepared away from home contains more calories, total fat, and saturated fat, while containing less dietary fiber, calcium, and iron on a per-calorie basis.
Even if you choose something healthy, like Subway, you're going to make a healthy choice. Your sandwich is going to be, you know, maybe 100 more calories than a sandwich from home, just because it's a bigger portion, it's more bread, you're just going to eat more calories.
Standing in the midst of several concession stands in the University of Kentucky's Rupp Arena, a slim Susie Colburn agrees. Her 17-year-old daughter, Sydney, has cheered the Marshall County Marshals all the way to the state tournament. After years of gymnastics lessons and cheerleading, Colburn admits healthy eating doesn't always fit into the family schedule.
A lot of times, let's say, we try to do salads when we go through drive-throughs and things like that, but then when it's cold, I end up eating cheeseburgers and french fries because it's more comfort food.
From the stands, Michelle Clark watches her son Chase play ball against Scott County. In the past, when Chase and his older brother both played Marshall County basketball, the Clark family attended events 4 to 5 times per week. Clark says she and her husband tried to eat grilled chicken and salads, but burgers also got thrown into their menus. This didn't help their health.
Did you notice any negative effects on your health during the sports season?
I gained a lot of weight. A lot of weight. My husband did too, though.
These problems persist throughout the country as more and more people eat out. According to the USDA, Americans spent about 50% of their food budget in 2004 on meals prepared outside the home. That's up roughly 16% from survey results in 1974. So what should people do? Children obviously need activity. Sherry Ford, a veteran basketball and cross-country mom herself, says the answer lies in planning.
As much as you can around your busy schedule, eat at home. Make a pot of soup in the morning and put it in the crock pot. Put a roast in the morning. There's going to be things that you can do if you plan ahead.
The dietitian says when eating at home won't work, take a sandwich and a cup of yogurt to the game. Looking ridiculous is better than looking unhealthy. With some forethought, the entire family can stay fit. It just takes a will and a crock pot. For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
Next on Front Page Sunday, our weekly chat with Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston, and we hear about a Kentucky car salesman turning opera star. Well, maybe. That's on Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
Well, why they want to tell us that it's edible is just incredible. I certainly do not get it.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. This week, Kentucky's legislature did something it hasn't done in quite some time. That's agreeing to a state budget without the need of a special session. Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston speaks with Rick Howlett about what else happened this past week in Frankfort.
It looked like when we last talked a week ago, it was going to be fairly smooth sailing for the budget this year. And then suddenly there was talk about lawmakers going home without one and even the possibility of the governor having to call a special session. What were the sticking points?
The sticking points were for the House, it was over school construction, and it wasn't even for the next 2 years. It was actually for planning for 2014 through 2016. The House argues that these are, you know, they've been doing this basically pretty regularly since 1985, putting in bonds for future projects. It allows for schools to look ahead and see, you know, plan for and design for, you know, expansions or renovations a few years ahead. And obviously the Senate's big proposal was bonded debt. They wanted less debt, less bonded debt, less structural imbalance. So that was a sticking point. The Senate eventually gave in. There were some other small things, how to fund Rupp Arena expansion, renovations, the horse park. The Senate wanted less debt, less spending, and there's always a lot of posturing when you get to the end of a budget, and this year was no different, except for when the clock started really ticking, they actually came to the table and got something done.
So Governor Beshear proposed an austere budget at the beginning of the session, and that's pretty much what lawmakers are poised to approve.
Well, actually, lawmakers trimmed it down even more. Yeah. So the governor said that he had an inadequate budget to fund the needs of Kentuckians, and lawmakers put in even less money in. So I would hate to think what he would refer to this budget as, but basically it was a tight budget, and there's no way around that.
Is there any threat of a veto?
Well, I'm sure the governor will line item veto some items. He always does. But what's happening is of course, that conference committee compromise that we're talking about now, it has finally landed on lawmakers' desks. They are breaking and looking over the plan now before they vote on it. And with them voting on it, it allows them to come back 2 weeks from now and override any of the governor's vetoes, if he vetoes anything. But I would think he always usually has one line or two. And since he can go one by one, he could, you know, cross out an A, dot a T, or, you know, cross a T, dot an I.
Right.
He can really do whatever. So they're preserving their veto power, and I'm sure that veto will be used, and the lawmakers will talk about overriding them.
Lawmakers go home, and there's a veto period?
That's right. It's about a week and a half. They're planning to return on April 12th. Of course, the governor gets so many days to veto a bill or it becomes law. And so basically they give themselves plenty of time for the governor to veto bills. The clock does not officially start until Monday. So they give the governor plenty of time, then they come back, look at what he's vetoed, and decide whether or not they're going to override it or not. Basically, it's a nice little week and a half break. Lawmakers will be back up here either the 12th or the 13th, and they'll look at the bills and say, either we don't care or, yeah, we want to override this.
Are there any other big issues still on the table at this late date?
Well, there actually are. You've got the prescription pill bill, which is House Bill 4. Actually, they had a conference committee, which is closed. They could not agree, so now they're in basically free conference committee, which that means they can throw anything in there at that point. But that's probably likely to go to the veto day. The road plan is still delayed. That's going to go to the veto day, or they won't have one at all, House Speaker said. That would be disastrous. You're talking about not having funding for the Louisville Bridges project, for widening I-65. That could be disastrous. But lawmakers are pretty confident they'll get to the veto day and have an agreement. So those are the two big issues. Other than that, you've got a lot of issues that are getting sent to the governor's desk. Lawmakers are agreeing or disagreeing, and you know the leaders have to sign bills for them to go to the governor's desk. So we're still looking at that pseudoephedrine issue. It has not been signed by legislative leaders, so technically it is not at the governor's desk yet. And then, of course, the dropout bill.
Now, I'm still hearing commercials in support of calling your lawmaker in support of charter schools, but that's pretty much off the table for this session, right?
Yeah. Chairman Rawlins, basically, the Senate amended one of House Education Chairman Carl Rawlins' bill that dealt with districts of innovation, which is what he called charter-like program. They tacked charter schools on the end of that bill. That really upset the chairman, and he called that issue, both of those issues, his and charter schools, dead. And there really hasn't been any movement in the House to talk about, you know, taking up his bill again. So I believe charter schools are probably done, but they've made enough progress that they'll probably have a strong argument next legislative session.
Speaking of next session, one of the big disappointments for Governor Beshear this session was, of course, his casino gambling amendment failed. Do you think there's going to be any effort to revive it next time around?
You know, that's the chief initiative of the governor. So I have to think before he leaves office, we're going to continue to hear about and see this issue, what that issue looks like, whether it's, you know, statute or constitutional amendment. I don't really know. There's not a lot of talk about that right now. A lot of the focus is on the budget and the road plan. But I would have to think the governor will continue to try to find a way to get expanded gambling in Kentucky until he leaves office.
And I apologize if you mentioned this and I was distracted, but there was a tax amnesty bill was being considered. Is it still up for consideration?
Yeah, there's a compromise on that. Lawmakers are going to push that through. Not a whole lot of changes. A reduction from what the governor wanted in terms of, I guess, scope and people who are going to work on it. But at the same time, that will get done.
Now, this was not complete. Is this complete amnesty, or is this something we just work out something with the state on paying back taxes?
Yeah, I think you have to pay a portion of your back taxes. And then once you agree to the amnesty, you have to pay your taxes, I think, for 3 to 5 years in a row. You can't be late again, otherwise they'll come back for the full thing. But it allows for people to only pay a portion of their taxes and get the rest forgiven. You really see people who haven't paid their taxes, or corporations who haven't paid their taxes for 5, 8, 10 years. 10 years is the limit, but they're going kind of for the big dogs in this program.
They've had these in the past and collected a fair amount of money.
Yeah, and in this budget, they expect to collect $19 million, which isn't, I mean, in a $19 billion budget, yeah. Doesn't seem like a lot of money, but $19 million is a pretty good chunk of change when you're talking about, I mean, it's not Mega Millions cash, but, you know, it'll help the budget a little bit.
That's right, every little bit helps. Well, Kenny Colston covers the Kentucky General Assembly and issues in Frankfort for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too.
You hear Kenny's reports daily during WKMS newscasts, and you can find his online stories at WKMS.org. Dr. Stu Silberman is among the Commonwealth's leading advocates for improving public education, reacting to the Kentucky Senate's failure to fund a proposal to expand preschool services. Kate Lochte has the story.
Pritchard Committee Executive Director Dr. Stu Silberman visited Murray Thursday. He was superintendent of Davis County Schools before going to Fayette County Schools and then retiring and joining the Pritchard Committee. His merry eyes light up about coming back to the region to meet with civic groups about the high stakes in continuing work to improve public education in the Commonwealth. Despite the Kentucky Senate's refusal to fund Governor Beshear's $15 million proposal to expand preschool services, Dr. Silberman says the proposal will resurface.
We're not going to give up with this session. We're going to be right back, and we know it's the right thing to do. We are also focused on closing achievement gaps, and the best way to close achievement gaps is don't ever let them start. Quality early childhood program stops achievement gaps from ever starting. Think about it as a kindergarten teacher. Kids coming in, some can already read, some don't know their colors. That's a big gap to start with. Kids who go to a quality preschool, those gaps will be closed. They'll be coming in reading just like the other kids. So we're going to continue to push on that. We believe in it. It's part of our core. I think with the governor putting the $15 million in to start with, brought a lot more attention to what the need is. So there are a lot more people out there who are supporting it now than there were before.
The main focus of Dr. Silberman's current swing through the state is to encourage communities to keep the faith about the challenges of the latest change sweeping public education in the Commonwealth.
The Common Core standards are internationally benchmarked. Some of our courses that we might have been teaching in the 8th or 9th grade are now being taught in the 6th or 7th grade, some of our math courses in particular. And so we're going through an adjustment period. Teachers are getting used to what this new curriculum means. At the same time, there's a new assessment system coming down the pike. So we're starting to get some of that frustration taking place, and some of that will be alleviated with spring break to get refreshed and then to be able to come back, because this is a long haul for teachers at this point. I believe that down the road, this is the right thing to do for our kids. And we're asking people from the Pritchard Committee to support the Common Core in your communities and to support them when the pushback comes. So we have a group called Ready Kentucky that travels around the state and will do presentations to any community groups free of charge to let folks know what the Common Core is and get into a lot more depth than I'm doing right now and talk about the new assessment system. And we hope people will take advantage of that. All they need to do is call us and we'll send folks out.
My sense is the Common Core problem is that mixed with assessment is that it's going to look like kids are doing worse when they're actually ramping up to do better.
Oh, I think you're exactly right. And there are two issues with that. Number one, with a new assessment system coming in, we're moving from a scale of 140 to a scale of 100. Right off the bat, the scores are going to look lower if we did nothing else. Combine that with increased rigor, the scores are going to be lower. We're going to go through a period of adjustment, and then we'll see them go back up, and we just need to stay the course.
Learn more about current issues in and discussion about improving Kentucky's education at PritchardCommittee.org. One of its initiatives, the Commonwealth Institute for Parent Leadership, offers insight into public education budgeting and policies through six-day institutes in 3 2-day sessions, free of charge. For WKMS News, I'm Kate Lochte.
Many Kentuckians are focused like a laser on March Madness, but last weekend, while UK and U of L were advancing to the Final Four, another major national competition took place in New York City, where a Kentucky car salesman made a name for himself in the highly selective opera scene. Anthony Clark Evans is one of 5 2012 National Council audition winners. Rebecca Feldhaus has more.
Thanks for coming back. I mean, I would have never got to sell your car if you hadn't come back. Anthony Clark Evans is back at work at an Elizabethtown car lot talking about in-car sound systems and legroom to sell a Toyota Camry to Mary and James McCubbins.
Well, we'd rather get one in E-Town anyway.
Because it's closer. Yeah. Because I'm better sales, I'm better looking.
But earlier this month, the 27-year-old Owensboro native was performing his dream job on stage at the Metropolitan Opera. After battling his way through regional opera competitions over 2.5 months, Evans claimed the Metropolitan Opera National Council Audition's Grand Winner Prize. Other winners of the award include greats like Renee Fleming, Thomas Hampson, and Jesse Norman. In short, Evans had his time on one of the best-known and respected opera stages in the world, and now he is still in post-award shock.
Last week, I was sitting at my desk in the dealership, not even thinking about music whatsoever. And this guy was telling me why my car was terrible, but he still wanted to pay, you know, nothing for it. And I'm just like, where am I right now? I mean, it was totally surreal.
To answer Evans's question, he's in the driver's seat. He is the winner of one of the most prestigious opera competitions in the world, and he did it without a college degree. He studied voice at Murray State University for a few years. He got married and needed to support himself. So he moved to Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and got a job at Swope Toyota. Evans didn't just show up at the Met and enter the contest. He decided to enter district competition mere days before the deadline. He paid for a few extra vocal coaching sessions and went to Memphis. Then he just kept going. A win at the National Council Auditions has launched careers of numerous opera superstars, but there's no guarantee. Editor-in-chief of Opera News magazine, F. Paul Driscoll, puts it into perspective.
This is, make no mistake about it, the big time. But it is usually a prelude to the next step professionally.
Evans has made a heroic ascent in the past few months. His arias were solid. He rarely gets nervous, and it showed in his final concert performance.
In my opinion, if someone who comes from a background like his is still able to summon up the nerve to give a solid performance on all these various audition rounds, then he has an excellent chance of being able to keep his head on straight as he embarks on a professional career.
Dr. Randall Black was Evans' voice teacher during his time at Murray State. Black is enthusiastic about his chances at making it, but the work ahead will be a challenging test to his dedication.
It's exciting right now, but just as anything that is work, it will become less exciting with time. And it's when you get in the trenches and have to do that daily drudgery that the will to succeed, the will to do something special, really has to come to the forefront.
Black hopes for Evans to find what he calls an angel. Angels are those philanthropists who love the art so much they want to ensure new talent like Evans have access to resources they need. A successful opera career combines talent, hard work, a strong support base, and yes, some luck. It's going to take some luck, Evans says, to continue garnering attention at such a high level. Without regular singing gigs or a degree under his belt, Evans doesn't look that great on paper.
When they look at my resume, it's not going to say much. Da 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 da, nothing, 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 met. And then what I'm trying to avoid right now is da 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 da, nothing, nothing, met, nothing, 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 nothing. Because I think that may end up happening if I don't really keep my eyes on the ball right now.
Evans keeps no illusions about what's ahead. There are some singers who dropped off the map for years or even decades before making their professional Metropolitan Opera debut. Some burst on the scene and never left.
Is it going to be that, or is it going to be the other way, where I have to train for so long and then I finally make my glorious debut? Or is it going to be like a celebrated long career? To tell you the truth, I don't care, because at this point, it's going to happen.
One way or another, Evan says, he'll be singing opera for the rest of his life. For WKMS News, I'm Rebecca Feldhaus.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for being with us.